Did I say my name? At my age, I never know. Really, I don't remember. God almighty. Anyway, I'm glad to be here and be the guinea pig speaker. I'd like to just make a couple of personal comments. I'd like to thank the beginners. I've noticed over the last month that most of the people in the beginners class do not smoke at this meeting. They smoke in the beginners class and they don't smoke here. And I want to commend you for that. That's what Alcoholics Anonymous is all about. Given some little write-up for the benefit of someone else, and we expect nothing in return. That's called the spiritual foundation of our program. And that really is, when you're new, I don't know who the people are who have difficulty breathing, but I know that there are a lot of people in this room who really cannot handle smoke, and I like to smoke at the meeting. But what a little gesture it is just to give that write up for a half hour or an hour for the benefit of those few. And that's really, you know, when Dr. Bob gave his last talk, when he was dying and he knew he was dying, they asked him to address the World Conference, and they brought him in a wheelchair. And he only had a few weeks to live, and he knew that. And the doctors told him that there was no hope and that he would be dead within a few weeks. And he didn't want to speak at that last meeting. But it was a world conference, and they brought him up, and they brought him behind the podium with a microphone, and he raised his body up. And he gave a talk that lasted about a minute and a half, and that was his goodbye talk to Alcoholics Anonymous. And he said in that talk that if you boil Alcoholics Anonymous down to its most basic thought, Alcoholics Anonymous, he said, is love and service. And so those of you that are just giving up that little freedom for the love of somebody you don't even know and doing that little service, I commend you. I really do. Another personal comment, maybe it's inappropriate, but I thought I'd make it. A number of years ago, we had guest speakers come to this group, several of whom are now dead. And they were long-term members of Alcoholics Anonymous. John McHugh was one in particular. He was my grand sponsor. And he was 40-some years sober at the time when he came here. And after the meeting, he called me aside and he said, Frank, you've got something here. I mean, not me, this thing that's available to you. He said, the thing that impressed me more than anything else about your meeting is that the people were courteous enough to be in their seats prior to the meeting, and when the bell rang, silence permeated the room. He said, the amount of discipline that takes, I haven't seen anywhere else in many years in Alcoholics Anonymous. And later on, we had another guy who was about 30 to 40 years sober come, and he said a similar thing to me 3 years later. He said, I've never seen the group discipline. Lately, it seems to be, and I think it's our fault, I don't think we've explained to the newcomers, an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting can be a mob, or it could be a respectful gathering of people wanting to share. And it's really important, and it's a dramatic thing to start a meeting of this size promptly at 8:30 and have everybody quietly attentive. When this man rings the bell to the newcomers, that's our announcement that the meeting has in fact started. And silence at that point is a courtesy to the meeting. So I'd hope we never lose that. I hope we never lose that discipline. It shouldn't be that the secretaries have to get up and fight over the crowd to say who they are and start the meeting. And that's also true about the announcements. And it's not your fault because we haven't told you that. So maybe you will consider that. I'd like to talk just a few minutes before the coffee break about sponsorship, just a few off-the-cuff comments. For you that are new, I am not an authority on Alcoholics Anonymous, nor do I have any credentials. I have no credentials. I'm just a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. So you don't have to pay any attention to anything I say. It's when I say it, it doesn't mean it's fact. It means that's the way I see it. And you may not see it that way, and that doesn't mean you're right or I'm right. But I'd like to talk about sponsorship as a pigeon, and then after this coffee break, talk about sponsorship as a sponsor, and maybe put those two things together. I had an advantage when I came into Alcoholics Anonymous. I think, in retrospect, when I look back, my sobriety date is November 3rd, 1971. When I came into Alcoholics Anonymous, I was in terror. I was terrified. I was terrified as to the hopelessness in which my life had now grasped me. I mean, I was out of control. Now, the observer, a third-party observer, would not have seen that because, like most people who are in terror, I covered it up and I tried to not show that panic, that confusion, and that terror. But I remember when I came into Alcoholics Anonymous, I did not speak at meetings for a long, long time. And I got good advice from the early people that I met in Alcoholics Anonymous. They told me this. They said, look it, you don't know what you're talking about. And you don't know the meaning of truth. And that's not to put you down, but why don't you just take it easy and listen? Why don't you just take it easy and listen? And maybe if you do that for a period of time, you'll start to understand things that maybe you won't if you're talking. And for a long time, I went to little discussion groups and I just passed. As a matter of fact, for a long time, I think it was 3 months about before, see, in order to pass, I'd have to say my name, because you got to say your name at these meetings, right? So I'd say, my name is Frank, and I'll pass. I never said, my name is Frank, I'm an alcoholic, and I'll pass. I never did that for 3 months, about 3 months, I don't know. And the reason that I didn't do that is because I didn't know what I was. I knew that I was on the verge of losing control totally of my life. And I knew that alcohol and other things were responsible for that, but I just was reluctant to make that statement. Maybe I was afraid that if I made that statement, I'd have to surrender and maybe want to come back or continue to come back. See, I never wanted to come back or continue to come back. I did not dislike the meetings. I did not dislike the meetings. I just didn't understand hardly anything that was said early on. I really didn't. As I look back, I was at all kinds of meetings, first step, fifth step, 12 step, general discussion meetings, and most of it went over my head. They used terms I didn't know anything about, and I just listened. I got a sense of hope, though, that something was happening in those rooms. So to my advantage was the fact that when I came into Alcoholics Anonymous, I did not force myself to perform. I was so terrified and self-conscious. See, I think there's two kinds of people that come into Alcoholics Anonymous. There are the superior types, and there are the types that feel totally inferior. And I was the second type. I had, by the time I came into Alcoholics Anonymous, pretty well concluded that I was garbage. I was ashamed of myself, and I was ashamed of a lot of things I did, and I had so many secrets that I just never thought they'd be resolved. So when they said to be quiet, I didn't mind that at all, because I just didn't mind it. I didn't have any argument with that. And in the early days, they pointed out to me, there are no shortcuts to Alcoholics Anonymous. See, when you're a newcomer and you see people who are long-term sober, you don't sometimes understand that's how they look today. That's not how they looked yesterday. 10 years ago, 15 years ago. See, if any of you saw me on November 3rd, 1971, George, are you here? George here? Yeah. I was garbage. Now, George got a piece of garbage when he got me. Not that I wasn't a human being, but I had a sense of worthlessness. And I felt that way for a long time, a really a long time. And I would, one of the things I had going for me, though, I think, was desperation. Around Alcoholics Anonymous, I hear, everywhere I go, no matter where I go to speak, I hear some people say, they're coming in too young. And when they say that, it's like the hair on my neck goes up. I say, wait a minute. I mean, well, what is this? But you know, in a strange sense, I think I know what they mean to say. It's not a prejudice against youth. Desperate people will do these things. People who are not desperate won't do these things. See, when I got here, I had totally given up on my successful use of alcohol. I mean, I knew it. There was no argument. I was as low as I could be. I was as bankrupt as I could be, and that had nothing to do with material things. My sense of self-worth was at an all-time low. So it wasn't difficult for me to want what you have. Now, I think some people who have not experienced that bottom, and I hear bottom, like people say, I was a high bottom drunk. God, I don't understand that. I mean, I just, if bottom is a sense of total frustration and worthlessness, I don't know how there can be a high one. I mean, really. Garbage. Oh, it's high garbage. I mean, I don't understand that. And maybe they're referring to what they didn't lose or material things or something. I don't know. I think that my advantage was desperation and terror. I had no argument that I was emotionally ill. When I saw the word insanity in the second step, I never argued about that. And I laugh sometimes when people stay at the meetings, new people, well, I don't understand that insanity. I mean, I don't like that idea, sanity. I have a videotape in my mind that I can press at any time, and I will play any one of 5,000 pictures, all of which are totally insane. I mean, I don't have any argument with insane. I did, acted, thought, reacted in such insane ways. I mean, what's the argument? I mean, I may not have been certifiable. I should have been. Really, for my own safety and for the safety of the general public, it might have been better that they had put me aside for a while. You know, just, you okay, stay in this room for a while. You're not goofy, you're just weird, and rest. And it may have been good, so I never had any problem with that. I think when they say that they're too young, I don't know if age has anything to do with it. If a bottom has occurred and you're new, that's all that I think is required. But I think you have to have hit a bottom. Because no one that doesn't hit a bottom would do things like come to believe that a power greater than yourself could restore you to sanity. No one who hadn't hit a desperate bottom would ever stay around long enough to make a decision to turn my life and my will over to the care of God. I mean, only desperate people will do that. Only people who are terrified by how they're living. If you're not terrified and you're not desperate, how could you or why would you make a searching and fearless moral inventory and then, without any terror or desperation, choose a stranger to share that information with? So I think what they're talking about and what they're referring to is that a lot of people, see, after 18 years, if there's a frustration in me, it's the frustration that more people don't stay here. I just, I've never been able, and as the years are rolling by, I become more sensitive to the fact that more people leave than stay. And I say to myself, why is that true? And when you're new, you don't see that because you're new and you think this is for you. This, we all came here getting ready for you. We've had 54 years to accumulate people. The population of the United States has grown faster than the membership of Alcoholics Anonymous. The truth is that we are not even growing in direct proportion to the population explosion. So AA has no growth. And I say to myself, but there appears to be growth because there's more meetings and there are more people, but it isn't true. More people are coming, but no more are staying. And when you're new, you don't see that. You just assume this is the way it's supposed to be. And I think the bottom line is only desperate people stay here. Only people who can't forget the desperation, the hopelessness, stay here. People who are committed to their own recovery at all costs stay here. See, I have no choice. I can't go anywhere. I can't not come here. There are many days that I say to myself, I don't want to go. It's hot. I'm tired. The difficulty with that is, I know me. If I don't go once, it's easier not to go twice. And after three times of not going, it's hard to go again. So I do this, and everything else I do, not because I'm recovered or because I love the meetings. I don't love the meetings. I do this as a commitment, my protection against the terror that once was part of my life and can return. I'll tell you how I know it can return. There have been times in my almost 18 years of sobriety that I have taken small vacations from Alcoholics Anonymous. Sometimes I'd be out of town for long periods of time, and I'd take a little vacation from going to meetings. Now, that's happened more than once during this period of time. I'll tell you what I've noticed each and every time. By the second week, I'm starting to get weird. I'm getting critical. I'm starting to find fault easily. I am nervous. I am angry. I can't get enough of this, that, or the other thing. I remember once I didn't go to meetings for 3 weeks. It was a long time ago, and I was away, I don't know where I was, and I walked into the restaurant with my wife, and in front of me were about six couples waiting to be seated. And I said, let's get out of here. She said, why? I'm not waiting in line. We went to another restaurant. This was a resort community. Six couples waiting in line. I said, let's get out of here. I'm not waiting in line. Third restaurant, 10 couples. I says, I'm going to get out of here. She says, that's good. I'll meet you after I eat. Now, for years prior to that, I had no difficulty waiting in line because when I go to meetings, my sense of self-importance is not a problem. When I didn't go to meetings, my sense of self-importance became a problem. Now, I never wanted to drink in any of these instances, but the terror and that frustration and hopelessness that I felt in the early days is still so dominant in my life that it can return, and it returns slowly as my inaction increases. That's why when I heard years ago and was repeated by one of our speakers from California, something that was not new and he didn't make it up, but he reminded me of it, and that is that alcoholism is a progressive illness that progresses throughout sobriety. And so the bottom line is, if you want a shortcut to the recovery process in Alcoholics Anonymous, and you're new and everybody wants that, the shortcut to getting comfortable or getting some sense of it's okay in Alcoholics Anonymous is through sponsorship. If there's anything that can shorten the process of recovery to make it happen quicker, it is through sponsorship. And early on, I had an advantage that some people don't have. I was so desperate and I was so terrified that I did what everyone told me to do. I don't believe, George was never my sponsor. I don't know why. I didn't like him, but that wasn't enough reason. No, and I don't mean that. But he never was. But I never did not do what George told me to do. And the guys at that meeting, our early meeting, no matter what they suggested, I did. If they said talk, I talk, shut up, go, don't, whatever it was, based on terror. And when they said get a sponsor, there was no problem for me. I think that by getting a sponsor, I saved myself a lot of trouble. It was, when I came into Alcoholics Anonymous, I had killed God. I mean, God did not exist. Out of self-defense, I killed God. I mean, there can't be a God. If there's a God and he's going to get me, I have to deny his existence and maybe somehow he won't get me. And I'd gone through this crazy stuff. I could never have surrendered to a God, I don't believe, this is just my case, unless I first surrendered to a sponsor. And I never in my life ever, I can't remember one instance when I did not do everything that my early sponsor told me to do. The day he told me to write my fourth step, I started that fourth step 20 minutes after he told me. And he told me to write my fourth step on Thursday and that I would do my fifth step on Saturday. And I wrote my fourth step on Thursday and I went where he told me to go on Saturday and I did my fifth step on Saturday with someone who I did not know. But it never dawned on me to argue or to ask why, because I had enough terror and frustration. Maybe what happens sometimes is maybe people are coming here at Alcoholics Anonymous and they have no sufficient motivation. I was reading in the book in the 12 and 12 the other day, and it was telling people like me, don't try to give motivation to newcomers. Let alcohol do that. In the 12 and 12, it says, our greatest ally is John Barleycorn. That's how they used to refer to as alcohol. Don't try to impute into a resistant person some sense of hopelessness and terror. It cannot be. Let them drink, or let them do whatever they have to do to become so terrorized and so hopeless that they won't argue anymore. And maybe that's why Alcoholics Anonymous only works for a part of the people that come here. Maybe you just got to have had enough to have the fight removed from you. Now, if you're new and you didn't come that way, let me just give this one word of advice to you, my opinion, it doesn't mean anything. If you come here without hopelessness, that's the way it is. But be willing, after you're here, to be open-minded enough to be able to review your life to find hopelessness. a sense of understanding hopelessness can come 3 months after you come here, or 5 months after you come here. This is about saving one's life. But if you don't think your life is at risk, it's no big deal. And I guess if I didn't think my life was at risk, it wouldn't have been any big deal for me. But it is, and it was, and it always will be. So if you want a shortcut, a newcomer came up to me a few days ago and he said, I want what you have. I'm going to tell you a secret. If you would have seen me in 1971, 1972, 1973, 1974, 1975, and 1976, you would not want what I had. What I have, if I have anything, and nobody knows if I do but me, because nobody sees the video but me, is a result of surrendering over that period of time. Surrendering, not arguing, not demanding, not requiring. I got the best advice that I could have ever gotten when I was new, and I'll give that to the newcomer. This is about love and service. This is not about what can you get, how happy can you get, how fast you can get that happiness, how fast your problems will remove, how fast you'll get clear thinking, how fast the spiders and the snakes will leave your mind. This is about love and service. If you take the position that your job in Alcoholics Anonymous is to be of service, everything else will follow. If you come into Alcoholics Anonymous, I think, asking to be recovered or made recovered, it is never going to happen. The early people in Alcoholics Anonymous discovered the secret right from the beginning. We can't help ourselves. We get well in direct proportion that we care about her. We don't know her. We don't know anything about her. But the sense of her terror is enough to make me distract myself from me and care about her. That's why when sometimes we have first birthdays and I sit in the back of the room, I have been here a long time, and I was here before we had any birthdays. There are still almost monthly times when chills go through my body when I see people get up here who were so full of terror, so full of self-hatred, get up here and say, I never thought this day would come. I'm now sober 1 year. And I think to myself, what a powerful thing. And yet I look around sometimes and I look and I know that there are people who just couldn't care less. Well, if you're new, the best advice I could give you is try to care. Because what this is a sharing of caring. Care enough to pick up an ashtray. Care enough to be attentive. Care enough not to talk when somebody's speaking. Care enough to listen to somebody who doesn't look impressive. Care enough to share in the fact that that person has a difficult time coming up here. Do you know that for some people this is the most threatening thing in the world? To just get up in front of this group and talk for 5 minutes is the most difficult thing they've ever done in their sobriety. And they don't have wonderful stories, they don't have exciting stories, and they don't have any insights. What they have is a demonstration that the power that they have gotten from Alcoholics Anonymous did, if nothing else, it got him the ability to get out of that chair, to sit in that chair, and then when called upon to stand here and say, my name is Alice and I'm an alcoholic. If nothing else, folks, that is chill producing, if you care. And I'm a person who didn't know how to care about anybody but me early on. And when they said to me, when you start caring, you'll start getting better. And that's really the best advice I ever got. Let's have that coffee break, huh? Just a couple of comments on being a sponsor. I have made every mistake that a sponsor has ever made in Alcoholics Anonymous. When I first started to sponsor people, I had the distorted view that if they did exactly what I told them, they would get well by my definition of well. When I was new to sponsorship, I kind of didn't understand that everyone sees things differently. And I made some grave errors trying to force everybody to act and react exactly in the same way. I think sponsorship is, in some senses, the most difficult thing that one does in Alcoholics Anonymous. And on the other side of the coin, I think it's, without a doubt, the most rewarding thing that anyone does. The difficulty I experienced early on in sponsorship, and I don't know, maybe there's some of you that have had that, it seemed to me sometimes that I wanted it more for that person than that person wanted it for themselves, and I would not accept that answer. And I figured that my job was to make them want it. And, you know, when I look back at people I sponsored many, many years ago, I kept people in Alcoholics Anonymous who didn't want to be in Alcoholics Anonymous and who subsequently left Alcoholics Anonymous. And when they left, I had a sense of failure, as if somehow I had failed. You know, that I hadn't said the right thing or acted the right way. I've changed over the course of time. I think now I sponsor everyone differently. I sponsor them the way I perceive them needing sponsorship. Example, I don't sponsor new people. I want to sponsor new people. But because of my involvement in the beginner's class, these are very susceptible people, and early on, many of them would say, "Would you be my sponsor?" Well, it didn't take me long to realize that if I took advantage of their susceptibility, I'd have 1,000 pigeons. And then I'd be nuts. So I made a rule many years ago that I wouldn't do that. And every once in a while, when one of my pigeons would leave for parts unknown, I would work with somebody who's relatively new. If I get somebody who is arrogant and cocky, I treat them very rough. If I get someone who, like me, feels worthless, like I felt worthless, I treat them with great love and great kindness and great patience, at least to the ability that I have. I don't think there's a right or wrong way to sponsor people. But I don't think now, the way I am now, I don't believe the sponsor's job is to enforce or impress upon the person who they sponsor with a sense of conduct. I think a sponsor's role is to look and act right. The best way to sponsor somebody, I think, is to be a role model. I really think that's true. When I came into Alcoholics Anonymous, they told me, one guy sat me down one day in a restaurant, and he said, "I'm going to tell you something. Now, I'm new." He said, "How you dress is a reflection of how you think of yourself, what you think of yourself." And I'll tell you, I never forgot that. And he didn't mean fancy or expensive or new. He was talking about clean, presentable. And I never forgot that. And that's why we started years ago that the speakers wore ties and suits. because our job is to make, to present AA in its most favorable light to the people who are new to Alcoholics Anonymous. And I think that's what a sponsor's job is. Simply to, if you're going to sponsor somebody, I think you take upon yourself the obligation to act in the best tradition of Alcoholics Anonymous. Tell you a secret. Every Labor Day, almost every Labor Day, all the guys that I sponsor and I go to Naples, Florida for 5 days. And we just are together. One of the things, now Naples, Florida is a resort community and it's a big beach, and this big house we rent is right off the beach. Just walk a few yards and you got the beach. And the beach, like any other beach, is full of attractive, provocative women. The rule in our home is, in our house in Naples, and everywhere my pigeons gather, no conversation ever is ever mentioned about war stories, who we did what to, or look at that. We do not diminish the sanctity of our togetherness with lewd or degenerate conversations. We do not countenance or permit or involve ourselves in any filth. And we have done that now for a lot of years. Because we are the example of Alcoholics Anonymous visiting that town. And the best example of Alcoholics Anonymous, it is not portrayed by a bunch of starving, hungry wolves on a beach. And now my guys take great pride in walking past the bikini and not seeing it. And I know that's true, because I look at the bikini and then look and see if they're looking. But that's what I think a sponsor does. A sponsor says, look it, you want to be right, act right. You want to be right, act right. Alcoholics Anonymous is me. When I go in a room, I am the representative of Alcoholics Anonymous. Alcoholics Anonymous doesn't want to talk about smut. Alcoholics Anonymous doesn't want to look at X-rated movies. Alcoholics Anonymous doesn't want to talk like people that do those things talk. I may want to do it, and the other people may want to do it, but we all also want to not do it. And the best way of not doing it is to find a role model that appears not to do it and act like them. And I think that has to do with tolerance. I think that has to do with scandal. I think that has to do with criticism. The greatest turnoff I remember having, George, I was sitting in that, we used to stop at that restaurant on Western Avenue, 111th or something, and I was sober about 7 months. And we got into a restaurant. I used to always go to a restaurant afterwards. And do you know, for 1 hour, the conversation was ripping other people apart. And I never went to a restaurant since that day. And I never go to restaurants anymore. And you guys, you know that. I mean, I occasionally walk in and get a Coke and leave. But I didn't come to Alcoholics Anonymous to learn how to do that. I do that naturally. I know how to attack people, criticize people, bring people down, talk against people. That's in my nature. I don't have to learn that. I'm the world's expert at that. Learning how not to do that is my dilemma. So when I took on the role of sponsor, gradually I've come to understand that my sole job is to be the best example of Alcoholics Anonymous, and then let that person do whatever they want to do. And I set rules for my guys, but they do not have to comply with them. Because who am I to tell them what to do? I say, this is something I suggest you do. And if they don't do it, I never harp on it. I just refuse to discuss it ever again. If they say, I'm having trouble writing my fourth step. I say, write it Thursday. If they call Friday and want to talk about the fourth step, I say, have you done it? And they say, no, but, and that's the end of the conversation. We don't talk about it. Because why should we talk about it? If you don't want to do it, it's your right not to do it. But it's also my right not to talk about it. I mean, why should we play that game? We don't own the people we sponsor. And they will outgrow us, in a sense. I'll tell you what I came to understand about being a sponsor. And maybe this will help some others who are at my dilemma. A dramatic thing happens in sponsorship that hurts sponsors if they don't approach it right. When you first become a sponsor, your pigeon loves you. They respect the ground you walk on. They see no fault in you. They see strength and hope, and that makes you very happy. As they recover, they start to see your faults. That doesn't make you so happy. Then, as they progress in their recovery, they don't talk to you. And that doesn't make you so happy. And about 2 years ago, I had a dilemma with a lot of the people that I sponsor. And one day I'm sitting there and I'm thinking, most of the guys I sponsor are doing better than I am. Because they never call me about anything, and I'm calling Bill Dixon all the time. Then it dawned on me that sponsorship is like motherhood or fatherhood. The child who looks at the mother or the father as an infant sees strength, safety, wisdom. As that child grows into adulthood, the parent looks weak, dominant, unjust, and incapable of understanding. If you have pigeons who are at that point, here's the good news. If you continue to act like you're supposed to act, someday they will like you again. Because when I was 16 and 26, my dad was a goof. Today, he's a wise old guy who's done the best he knew how. And that's what happens in sponsorship. I see sometimes, though, in people who are sponsoring, a reluctance to allow the person to go through that process, almost a need to dominate and totally control forever, as if your job is to prevent them from experiencing pain. The greatest lessons the people I've sponsored have ever learned is when I say right, it has nothing to do with my wisdom. Right, for example, this. It's impossible to maintain any spiritual growth as a married person while you also have a girlfriend. It's impossible. It's impossible to maintain any spiritual growth when your tongue is obscene. It's impossible to maintain serious emotional and spiritual growth when you continue to lie or steal. I mean, simple little things. I mean, there's no great wisdom. I said this at Joe's meeting about good, and I think maybe I was misunderstood, Joe, and I don't know. I said at Joe's meeting last Friday, when I came into Alcoholics Anonymous, they told me, we are sick people trying to get well, not bad people trying to get good. And I said, that's okay. I'm going to tell you a secret. I no longer believe that. I believe that, but I also believe the flip side of this. I cannot get well and continue to act badly. I cannot get well and reserve the right to perpetuate guilt actions. It's just impossible to grow spiritually and steal, to lie, to cheat, to assassinate, to criticize, and to slander other people. You can't tell me, and I learned this, and I don't know if it's true for you, I learned that I could not feel good after tearing someone else down. Now, early on in most of my life, that's the only time I ever felt any good. Feeling so inferior that I had a compulsion to tear you down if you looked or sounded better than me, to elevate myself. I mean, I had that need. Most of my life I had that need. You can't continue to do that and get a good sense of yourself. And that's the kind of stuff I tell my guys. I don't tell them any great secrets. I tell them, look, you can live any way you want and do anything you want. That's your right. And I don't know how you should live because I don't live in your home. But if it's bothering you, you should not do it. That's all. If it's bothering you, you should give it up. That's simple. And I tell them to go to meetings, be the best possible representative of Alcoholics Anonymous, and tell people that Alcoholics Anonymous works, period. How they should talk, how they should walk, when they should do this and when they should do that, I don't know. You know another secret? I don't know if it's true, and I think people have misread this. I never tell anybody I sponsor to take a step. I have never, ever done that. I've never told them to take a step. I have never said, you're going to take that step. I wait for them to tell me about the pain in their life, and then I suggest to them that the way they may relieve that pain is by taking that step. And that works better than anything else, because then I don't have to convince them that they should do it. They report to me, I'm in pain, and I say, well, then why don't you just try to do this? And if they do it, that's their business. And if they don't, that's the way it is. So I don't get my heart broke anymore when I sponsor people, because I just know that that's not my job. Not my job to tell them what to do. I don't own them. And they are not a badge of who I am. Sometimes you get the feeling that people get a lot of pigeons. That somehow elevates them in the eyes of their group. I never thought that that was an elevating process. I don't think you're a big shot AA because you sponsor 25 people and somebody else is a no account AA because they don't sponsor anybody. I don't think it has anything to do with anything. So we don't own them, they don't give us any hash marks, and we don't take credit for their recovery. And I don't take credit for anybody's recovery. Hey, I don't know anything more about Alcoholics Anonymous than anybody else in this room. The only thing I know is that it works for those people who work it, and it doesn't work for people who don't work it. That's as simple as that is. And if a guy wants to keep fooling around, that's his business. Or a gal, I don't sponsor women. And that's an interesting thing. I wonder if I'll ever sponsor women, Marty. Wonder if I ever sponsor women. You know why I never sponsor women? I don't know how to put this in words. When I was new to Alcoholics Anonymous, 4 or 5 years sober, there was a young girl at a meeting, and she came into the meeting, and she was there. It was an all-men meeting, and she came in. I'll never forget her. George, it was at 103rd. The lady had the longest legs. Remember? And she came in and said that she had spent a good part of her latter life as a prostitute. And she was so pretty, and she was so young. And I was thinking to myself that day, after I stopped looking at her legs. I stopped looking at her legs about 4 days after the meeting. I'm thinking to myself, God, could I help that girl? And I could just picture myself sitting in the car while she was reading her fourth step to me and telling me how terrible she felt about it. And the snake in me would say, one more won't hurt. Oh, God. Geez, if you feel so bad having charged for it, why don't you give it away for nothing? Maybe it won't hurt. So I'll never be that well, and I limit myself to sponsoring men. So I don't know. I'll close because it's over. It's late and it's hot. I want the best for the people I sponsor, but if they say they're doing okay, that's the way it is. If they say they're not doing okay, I'm there to answer their questions. But I'm not a people creator anymore. I'm not going to mold people into what I think they should be, because I'm not that smart, nor do I have that power. So I'm a loose kind of a sponsor, I guess. I really am. But I do one thing. When I'm around, they seem to shape up. They really do. They seem to shape up. So anyway, if you're having trouble with sponsorship, you don't have to try to be a sponsor. Just try to be a good AA person. That's the best thing you could do. Because if the person you sponsor wants what you have, he will get it. And if he doesn't want what you have, whatever that is, he can't have it no matter how hard you try to give it to him. Because this is for people who want it, not for people who need it. And we've all worked with a lot of people who don't want it, trying to make them want it. And I don't know about you, but I haven't been too successful doing that. So that's all I have to say. Thank you.